From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome, everyone, to Washington Watch. Coming up, we're now just 42 days away from the 2020 presidential election, and on Friday, with the passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, an already fever-pitched election just got more intense, as the filling of this vacancy, if done right, will shift the balance of the court. Democrats are saying the nomination should wait until after the election. At least that is what they're saying now. Can the Senate confirm a nominee in what will most likely be about a 35-day window? Tennessee Senator Marsha Blackburn said she looks forward to President Trump's nominee receiving a full vote on the Senate floor. Senator Marsha Blackburn, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, joins us later here on Washington Watch with the latest. And there are the politics of filling a Supreme Court vacancy that only gets more fervid with each new nomination. But there is also the history. What does it tell us about the appropriateness of filling this vacancy before an election? When we talk about the courts, we often hear about precedent. So what is the precedent on filling vacancies in an election year? We'll talk about it in just a moment with Dan McLaughlin, who has written about this in the National Review. Over the weekend, President Trump said this.
I will be putting forth a nominee next week. It will be a woman, a very talented, very brilliant woman, who I haven't chosen yet, but we have numerous women on the list.
Travis Weber joins me for a review of the women on the list. And get ready, I'm going to ask you to weigh in. I'm going to open up the phone lines a little bit later. I haven't done that in a while, but get ready. The number 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. I'm giving it to you in advance. I want to get your opinion. Do you think the president should nominate and the Senate confirm a justice to the Supreme Court before the November 3rd election? You can also text me your answer. Text the word radio to 53445. That's the word radio to 53445 and let me know what you think. I'd like you to weigh in. All right, coming up tomorrow night, you know what it is? I heard that. The Values Voter Summit. That's right. Coming up tomorrow night, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, the Values Voter Summit, going to be running all week long, beginning tomorrow night through Friday night. You can find out more about how you can be a part of this year's Virtual Values Voter Summit. So it's the VVVS. It's the Virtual Values Voter Summit, and you can be a part of it. Go to TonyPerkins.com, follow the links over, and you can register to be a part of this event. So far, I think close to 4,500 folks have registered to be a part of it. You can as well. So go to TonyPerkins.com, sign up to be a part of it. All right, as we mentioned, former Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away on Friday. Now, she was viewed as an icon by many, but what can we expect as a new justice is set to be nominated and potentially take the bench? Many are saying a vote before the election would be disrespectful or an abuse of power, but should we expect the president to try and put a new face on the court? What does the process look like? What does history tell us? Joining us to talk more about the history of this is Dan McLaughlin. He's written a piece that for the National Review called History is on the Side of Republicans Filling a Supreme Court Vacancy in 2020. Dan, welcome to Washington Watch.
Glad to be here.
Now, Dan, I know you actually wrote this piece before there was actually a vacancy, and so you wrote this just, I guess, putting it out there for discussion. But let me just start with the title. History is on the side of Republicans. You say that history says they should fill it.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot of water under the bridge here from 2016, obviously, and people claiming that Republicans are being hypocritical. But in fact, if you look at history, I mean, I think you have to look at both the president and the Senate, right? There have been 29 occasions in U.S. history when there was a vacancy either in an election year or in the lame duck session before the new president and new Senate were seated. In all 29 of those cases, the president made a nomination. Almost all of them, the president made a nomination very soon. Really, the only occasions where, typically where the president has waited until after the election, were because the Senate was out of session. And so this has been done by presidents throughout history, Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Lincoln. FDR did it. Grant did it. President Obama tried to do it. Now, as far as what the Senate has done, the answer to that is very simple, too. When it's an election year, if the president's party controls the Senate, the president gets his way. 17 out of 19 times, the president has gotten his way, and one of the other two was essentially a technicality. Whereas on the 10 occasions when the opposing party controlled the Senate, only once out of 10 times did the president get his nomination through. So in that sense, the distinction that Mitch McConnell and Republicans in the Senate have drawn between when the president and the senator of the same or different parties is very much one that is supported by the history.
So bottom line is the president does what the president does and the Senate does what the Senate does. And when they're together, the president gets his nomination through.
Yes. And so the idea of saying we're going to hold this off because it's an election year and let the voters decide, it assumes that there's something for them to decide. Right. It assumes that there's a disagreement between two branches of government that have both been elected by the voters. And that's what you had in 2016. The Republicans had won the Senate in 2014. They had campaigned a good deal on the courts. And so they were able to go to the voters and say, you know what, we have a Republican majority. You elected us. We are going to put the question to you one more time. And the voters came back and elected not only Donald Trump, but reelected a Republican Senate majority in 2016 and expanded that majority in 2018.
Right. So they have the authority right now. They have, you could basically say, the mandate from the American people from the last election, which is the last time the American people spoke. But, Dan, you make a point in your piece, as you point out, and folks don't really completely grasp how the Senate operates by tradition and by rule. I mean, you have these rules and you have traditions, and you don't deviate very much from precedent. You argue that if the Republicans do not fill this vacancy, they would actually be setting a new precedent that could be dangerous in years ahead.
Yeah, it would be a break with all of American history. I mean, nobody has ever voluntarily decided that they didn't want to try to fill the seat. And I really think that it's what Republican voters sent a lot of senators and the president there to do, as much as anything else, was to ensure Republican control of the courts. So, you know, it's one thing when you have a power that you could exercise, but that history suggests you should be very cautious in exercising, right? There are emergency powers, certainly, that the government has that you have to be very careful in breaking that glass and saying, we're going to do this. This is not one of those powers. This is a power that has been used pretty regularly. I mean, on three occasions in the past, we've had lame duck nominations, actually, by a president who had already lost re-election and went to the Senate and was able to get a Supreme Court justice through. The most famous of those, of course, is John Adams, who nominated Chief Justice John Marshall, the famous midnight judge. And this was after Adams already knew he had lost the election. His party controlled the Senate. They put Marshall on the court, and Marshall was essentially the father of American constitutional law. He wrote Marbury versus Madison.
So Dan, let's talk a little bit about the saber-rattling, the threat. Maybe it's not saber-rattling, the threats being made by Democrats who are saying, oh, if you do this, you've crossed a line, and this will open the door for us to, by just simple statutory vote, pack the courts.
I mean, they may have the power to do that. Of course, to do that, they will first have to win the presidency and the Senate, and then they will have to abolish the filibuster. And so there's a lot of steps there. And then even having done that, then they'll have to convince the American people that this is actually a good idea, because that was a large part of what happened to the Democrats in 1937. Franklin Roosevelt had a commanding majority in the Senate, and yet his own party refused to pass court packing because the voters rebelled against it, the newspapers rebelled against it, and even many Democrats rebelled against it. But I think Republicans have to consider the fact that, number one, the Democrats have a lot of hurdles they need to jump before they can do that. Number two, that's a fight that Republicans may be able to win even if the Democrats do get that power. And number three, do you really want to be caving to those kind of threats?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of, it's, you know, kind of goes back to Ronald Reagan saying, you know, we don't negotiate with terrorists. I mean, this is kind of one of those things that they may do it anyway. I mean, this is what Mitch McConnell's been talking about that is hanging in the balance of control of the Senate, because they can, you know, issue statehood to D.C., which they call for in their platform, giving them two more senators. And then they can expand the court, the Supreme Court, to dilute the president's constitutionalist that he's placed on the court. So they could do those things anyway if the Republicans, you know, say, oh, okay, we're not going to do this. We're going to set a new precedent. We're going to unilaterally disarm in this battle for this way that's been waging for the courts now for, you know, about five decades, and just walk away from it. But that has consequences for Republicans, does it not?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, you know, there's a lot of focus on, well, what is the downside for Republicans if they do this, right? That some swing voters will be mad at them, which is probably true in some places, that the Democrats will have a greater talking point and a greater incentive to do constitutional mischief. And that's probably true. But that's only looking at one side of the coin. I think there's an enormous number of voters who are Republicans or who are faithful Republicans who show up on Election Day in large part because of this, you know, the five-decade march to try to overturn Roe and other social issues, as well as not only social issues. There's a battery of issues that come before the court. But voters who have put a lot of trust in the Republican Party because they felt that it would fight for them on this specific issue. And these issues, these vacancies don't come around very often.
Yeah, I mean, for me, to use a football analogy, this would be to get the ball down within the, you know, within the 10-yard line. You're there, you know, first and goal, and you decide, you know what, we've had enough. We're gonna wait till the next quarter. We're gonna go to the locker room early. That would be insane. The fans would go crazy, and I think, as you pointed out, as the Republicans have run on each election on the courts and why it's so important, 2016 obviously being a great example of that, the voters have rewarded them by entrusting them with power because of the court. Now they have it. They should use it.
Yeah, and look, a good deal of why the whole Republican establishment was sort of shocked by Donald Trump's rise. Why did voters turn to Trump as a complete political amateur? In 2016, a good deal of that was the sense that people didn't trust the existing party to keep its promises. And so, you know, if you elect the Tea Party and then you elect Trump and then, you know, one Republican group after another doesn't keep its promises, you start losing people.
Right, right. And I think that's the that's what's at risk here for Republicans. Dan McLaughlin, thanks so much for joining. Great piece, very insightful, and even more so that it was done in advance of this vacancy. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks.
And folks, you can actually read it yourself. Go to TonyPerkins.com and follow it over. Good history of the courts, and he makes the clear distinction about the president, his responsibility, the Senate, their responsibility, and their power. And when the two are in sync, the president gets his nominees. When they're not, they don't. For the most part. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk about the president's list of women. He says it'll be a woman. Which one will it be? Which one should it be? We're going to talk about that with Travis Weber next here on Washington Watch.
Are you concerned with the state of our nation? And when looking at what's going on in our culture, do you wonder, what can I do? For the past 15 years, FRC Action has hosted Values Voters Summit, an event for people like you who want to shape the culture so that all human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. And this Values Voters Summit is going viral, so everyone can tune in and be encouraged to pray, to vote, and to stand in these significant times. Past speakers included President Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Dr. Ben Carson, and Dana Loesch. Register today for your free digital pass and join us virtually from September the 22nd to the 25th from 8 to 9:30 p.m. Eastern. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information. That's valuesvotersummit.org. Don't miss out. Remember, pray, vote, stand.
Since the 1973 Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision, Congress and many states have taken various actions to stop taxpayer dollars from funding abortions or the abortion industry. As early as 1976, Congressman Henry Hyde led the effort to ban federal funding for abortions. The Federal Hyde Amendment, named after him, established the principle that abortion is not health care, and therefore taxpayers should not be forced to fund abortions. Despite these efforts, the abortion industry still receives millions of dollars each year in taxpayer money. In 2019, Planned Parenthood, America's largest abortion provider, received $616.8 million in government funds. Family Research Council's newly updated pro-life map tracks how your state has taken action to stop taxpayer funding of abortions. Go to frc.org/pro-life maps to see where your state stands in the fight for life. That's frc.org/pro-life maps. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Hannah.
What's going on? Why so gloomy?
Well, I'm a little disappointed. I had a lot planned to do during the stay-at-home time, and I just didn't do it.
Oh, yeah? What did you have planned that you didn't get to do?
Well, I was actually hoping I would finally be able to get time to do a regular Bible reading routine, and I started a couple of times. I just didn't stick with it.
Don't be too down on yourself. Starting a new routine can be hard, but one way to help is to join in with others and to have a good game plan. I think I have a good solution for you.
Oh, yeah?
Tony Perkins and FRC are doing a 2-year study in the Word. They have it all mapped out.
When did they start? I would be so far behind.
Oh, that's not a problem. You can literally jump in anytime. There's a daily reading, just a couple of chapters a day, with questions to help you think about what you're reading.
Nice. Where can I find this?
Go to frc.org/Bible, and you can get started.
Where's that again?
frc.org/Bible.
Got it. Checking it out now.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. The website, TonyPerkins.com. Again, coming up tomorrow night, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, the Values Voter Summit. To find out how you can be a part of it, go to TonyPerkins.com. All right, as I mentioned at the top of the program, over the weekend, President, at one of his campaign rallies, made this statement about the vacancy on the court.
I will be putting forth a nominee next week. It will be a woman. A very talented, very brilliant woman. Who I haven't chosen yet, but we have numerous women on the list.
All right, joining me to talk about the women on the list is Travis Weber, Vice President of Policy and of Government Affairs here at the Family Research Council. Travis, welcome back.
Thank you, Tony.
And I know that there are really three major women in contention and contending for this position. I've had numerous phone calls over the weekend talking with different ones in and outside of government. And so what we're looking at Alison Jones Rushing. She serves on the Fourth Circuit. She was confirmed, I think, was it in 18 or 19?
She was confirmed last few years. We'll get the data on that.
And she was confirmed by a vote of 53-44. It was close. She was kind of attacked for her connection with the Blackstone Fellowship with Alliance Defending Freedom. And then there was Amy Coney Barrett, who was confirmed for the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. She was confirmed by, again, a narrow margin, 55-43. She was the one, and I know we talked about this on this program, because she was attacked for the dogma that was within her, because she is a devout Catholic, mother of seven children, two of them adopted from Haiti, and it was Barbara Boxer. Who went after her for the dogma that spoke loudly within her. And then the third, Barbara Lagoa, right? Is that how you say it?
That's correct.
Yeah, Lagoa from Florida. She's the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. The big distinction with her is that she was confirmed by an 80-15 margin, which gives me some pause. Anybody who gets through in this polarized world in which we live here in Washington, by such a wide margin, it gives me, polls, I should say. But let's that's a quick overview. I'll let you jump into to these as you see fit.
Sure, Tony. And as you mentioned, so Allison Rushing, her confirmation was October of 2018, and both her and Amy Barrett did receive hostile questions from the Senate when they were confirmed about their faith and their affiliations. Frankly, those are positive signs because when they identify with their faith publicly like they did and do not back down, this shows they're willing to defend that publicly, which is key for a nominee that we're going to that's going to be put through this onslaught.
I think that's absolutely right, especially given the environment in which we live right now, where public display, public expression, the First Amendment exercise of religion comes under attack.
And so this is a key checkmark in their favor, I'd say. We don't have as much on Lagoa. She's quieter on that front. When it comes to their rulings and public statements and positions on the issues, what we have now with Judge Barrett on the Seventh Circuit is several positive rulings on life and other constitutional rights where she has weighed in terms of or joining dissents or different components of opinions at the appeals court level that indicate she will rule favorably on the life issue and from an originalist perspective. Not as much with Rushing, but we have some evidence of that. Her dissenting from a Protect Life Rule Title 10 case in which the majority struck down President Trump's rule on that front. With Legault, we don't have as much to go on our issues when it comes to her record on the appeals court. And then when it comes to public pronouncements, Rushing and Barrett have records of public pronouncements identifying themselves as originalist conservatives and on our issues in a positive way, especially Amy Barrett, a lot of public pronouncements on life and her positions on life. Not as much from Lagoa. So what we have is some clarity on some of these candidates, mainly Barrett and Rushing, less so on Lagoa.
Now, the issue with – I shouldn't say issue. One of the favorable aspects of Rushing that has gained a lot of attention is that she is an evangelical Christian, and there are no evangelicals on the court. She is 38 years old. Has an established record, as you said, as a conservative, and as I mentioned at the top, a part of the Blackstone. She was a Blackstone fellow with the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is ADF is a close ally of ours and attacked by the same people.
Yeah, Tony. I mean, that was one of the affiliations she was attacked over. I'm also a Blackstone fellow with ADF. I mean, it's an esteemed program, and it's one that. We want to see people stand up and defend when they're attacked for it. And so that was good to see when she was questioned last time around. Frankly, there's been other things she said publicly in the past on our issues that she, to my knowledge at this point, has defended publicly, is not shying away from. At the same time, so is Amy Barrett. And so there's going to be a crucible whoever's nominated. And we need someone who's going to stand by their public positions and what they believe and not back away from it.
And what we cannot have is what we've had in the past where you have question marks, where you have people that do not have established either records or public statements, because then we end up with, Justice Kennedy's. We end up with even Chief Justice Roberts, where they're a big disappointment. I've never seen a justice appointed by liberals because of a liberal ideology become conservative. But I've seen the opposite many times.
Tony, we know the slide Roberts has taken, even Gorsuch's opinion in Bostock. This has got people on edge, and we can't afford to have the wrong nominee here. We're going to get a ruling on the Obamacare issue again later in the coming months. And so without Ginsburg or a reliable vote for that, how do we want we know where Roberts stands on that issue, at least in the last case. Where do we want our court to come down on? This is crucial for many cases in the years to come.
Yeah, not to mention that one of the reasons to fill this vacancy before the election, with all of the pending challenges to the election outcome that we anticipate, it could be another 2000 election when the Supreme Court actually decided the outcome of the election.
We're going to have political implications for the election cases that may come and other cases in the years to come. Absolutely.
All right. Travis Weber, sit tight for a moment. Folks, when we come back, I want to get you to weigh in. Should the president nominate and the Senate confirm a justice to the Supreme Court before the November 3rd election. I'm going to take your phone calls. Also, you can text me your response. We do that next when we return. Don't go away.
Aw, man.
What's wrong?
I just missed Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, and our congressman was going to be on the show today.
Oh, that's not a big deal.
What do you mean?
Well, you can always catch the replay of the day's show.
How's that?
With the Stand Firm app.
Yeah?
Yep, you can catch that day's program and so much more. You can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes while conveniently going about your day. You can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on the main feed, so you can stay up to date on local and national news.
Wow, I definitely use that. How do you find the app?
Just visit frc.org/app and download, or search Stand Firm in the App Store.
Okay, that's Stand Firm.
Yep, Stand Firm.
How do you know all this?
Because I'm a SageCon, but that's another story.
Huh?
As churches consider gathering again, they should develop plans to reopen and operate according to the guidance of the CDC, along with state and local guidance that does not violate the First Amendment and other religious freedom protections. Family Research Council has a helpful resource with best practices and tips for churches and places of worship to consider when crafting their reopening plans. Romans 13 instructs Christians to be subject to the governing authorities. The civil authorities have a difficult task ahead, and we should seek to be a part of the solution through cooperation and service to our communities. Some states and authorities like Nevada and California are treating religious entities more restrictively than non-religious entities. But as long as restrictions are temporary, applied equally to religious and non-religious gatherings alike, and there is a good reason for putting them in place, government restrictions are not likely to violate religious freedom protections. To learn more and to view this resource, visit frc.org/churchguidelines.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host, and as promised, I'm going to open up the phone lines. Here's what I want to know. Just tell me yes, no. Do you support the president? Do you think he should nominate and the Senate confirm a justice to the Supreme Court before the November 3rd election? Phone lines are open, 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. I know it's been a while, so your phones might be a little dusty there. 866-372-7234, or you can text me your answer. Text the word radio to 53445. That's 53445, the word radio, and let me know. Do you think the president should nominate and the Senate confirm a justice to the Supreme Court before the November 3rd election? All right, still to come, Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, is going to be with us in the next segment. She has said she looks forward to voting on President Trump's nominee on the Senate floor. So we're going to talk with her about that. In fact, she's not the only one. About 20 of her colleagues have already gone public saying they want to see this nomination move forward before the election. And as I was saying before the break, I think it's important because not only a number of important cases, the Obamacare case that Travis mentioned, but you remember 2020 and the hanging chads, I mean 2000, the hanging chads in Florida where the election was decided by about 560 some votes out of Florida that went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court in December ruled in favor of Bush, and he won the presidency. Now, what happens if you have a split court, 4-4 instead of 9, and Roberts goes wobbly? What happens then? All right, we're going to go to the phone lines. 866-372-7234, and I want to get to many of you as I possibly can. And so the question is, do you think the president should nominate and the Senate confirm a justice to the Supreme Court before the November 3rd election? We go to Milda in Arkansas. Milda, what do you think?
Yes, definitely. He should.
All right. Okay, Milda, thank you. Milda says, yes, he should. Let's go to Todd in Texas. Todd, what should he do?
Yeah, he should. He should nominate a Supreme Court justice.
And the Senate should confirm?
And the reason, absolutely, because we're losing our Christian values in this country. I mean, our kids are getting raised up wrong. They're not getting taught the values that I was when I was younger, and they're getting further and further away from it. And the court is going to be the thing that keeps us there, at least to some degree.
Yeah, good point. And that, thank you, Todd. And to Todd's point, it's the court has interjected itself into everything, and that's why the court is so important. And here it is within, potentially within reach, to see the shift of a court back within the boundaries of the Constitution. Let's go to Brian in Indiana. Brian, should the president nominate and the Senate confirm?
Yes, he should. I think it's his right, and it wouldn't be any different if he would die in office. They had to put the vice president and president, and they wouldn't wait for the new election. So why not nominate a Supreme Court justice?
Yep, because the Constitution lays out the process, and that is exactly the process that the president nominates, and then the Senate can take it up and do their advise and consent. And so they do their thing. The president does his thing. Let's go to Thomas in Louisiana. Thomas, what do you think?
Hey, I think he has the right to nominate who he wants to, and I'm all for it.
And the Senate should confirm?
Yes.
All right. Thomas, thanks for weighing in. Let's go to Lynn in Louisiana. Lynn, go ahead. What do you think?
Yes, he should.
He should? And the Senate, what should they do?
Yes, they should also confirm.
All right. Thanks so much, Lynn. Appreciate you listening and calling in. We're going to stay in Louisiana. A lot of folks in Louisiana listening. That's good. Josh from Louisiana, what do you think?
I absolutely think they should put somebody up and the Senate should confirm.
All right. All right. Thanks for weighing in, Josh. We're going to jump over to Georgia where Kathy is on the line. Kathy, what do you think?
Hey, absolutely. Yes, the president's responsibility is to put in the nominee and the Senate should confirm it. We are to run toward the fight.
A good point, Kathy. And that's been my advice to the White House is that, look, we've been fighting for these things for so long, and some things are worth fighting for. So get the strongest, best candidate, put the nominee forward, and we're willing to fight for those things. Don't put forward a milquetoast, weak candidate that excites no one. We're willing to roll up our sleeves and fight for it. Let's go to Diane in Texas. Diane, what do you think?
I think he definitely should put in the nomination. It's constitutional, it's his job, and they should vote on it.
All right, very good. Thanks, Dan. I'm going to go to John on the way out. John from Indiana, what do you think?
Yes, he should, and he should go for the gold. He should put in Amy Coney Barrett from Indiana, who's in Chicago as a federal judge now.
All right, John, thanks for weighing in. All right, there you have it, folks. But you can continue to weigh in. You can text me at 53445, the word radio, 53445. All right, when we come back from the break, we're going to be joined by a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee that will be involved in the confirmation process. Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee is here next. Don't go away. Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain. explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
The rapidly changing moral landscape of the 21st century presents a challenge for Christians committed to biblical sexual ethics. An uprising against morality has overturned centuries of norms concerning the family, marriage, and human sexuality. Secular culture is not the only challenger of Christian sexual ethics. Increasingly, theologically liberal churches and denominations are rejecting the church's historic teaching on marriage. As a result, Christians are facing increasing pressure to compromise the Bible's teaching on human sexuality. How should Christians who are committed to God's Word respond to these challenges? What does the Bible teach about sexuality? Family Research Council has a new publication that presents the biblical principles for human sexuality. It lays out a survey of culture, scripture, and church history that will help pastors and all Christians meet modern-day challenges to biblical sexuality with truth and love. To access this publication, visit frc.org/human sexuality.
The history of the United States is preserved in archives, books, and the collective memory of the American people. It is also preserved through monuments and memorials that visually represent the extraordinary history of our nation. To tell these stories and remind ourselves of the importance of these memorials, Family Research Council has a new blog series highlighting the most recognizable and popular monuments in our nation's capital. This series devotes particular attention to the historical and spiritual themes depicted in each monument, sharing some not-so-well-known facts about their history, design, and symbolic meaning that shed light on our nation's deep religious heritage. This series aims to inspire the next generation to see the importance of these monuments and to remind us of the virtues and lessons that they memorialize. To read FRC's Monument Series, visit frcblog.org/monuments. Again, that's frcblog.org/monuments.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Thanks so much, folks, for calling in and weighing in. I'm certainly going to report that back to the folks we talked to in the White House. And also, I would encourage you to continue to take the poll question online to text me the word radio to 53445. Also, coming up tomorrow night, another way for you to participate. It's interactive, the Values Voter Summit. Normally, we've got folks traveling from all across the country and literally from around the world coming to Washington for the Values Voter Summit. But because of the coronavirus, we will be doing it virtually. And so you can join from home, anywhere in the world, wherever home may be. All you have to do is register. Go to TonyPerkins.com, and it's interactive. So we'll have poll questions. We'll have other things that you can participate in. So it'll be almost like being there, but you can do so in your shorts and T-shirt. All right. Okay, joining us in just a bit, Marsha Blackburn, member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. She'll be joining us momentarily. And we're also going to talk to her about her new book that she just had coming out, The Mind of a Conservative Woman, Seeking the Best for Family and Country. And she's already gone on record saying that the president should nominate in the Supreme Court justice, and that the Senate should vote on it on the Senate floor, not just the committee, but the Senate floor. So I think she's going to be joining us here momentarily. What's interesting is how the back and forth. Now, I was talking about this with Dan McLaughlin about how in 2016. Mitch McConnell, with the death of Scalia, said, look, we will not fill this vacancy until after the election. Now, the point being is what Dan said. You had the Senate controlled by one party, a divided government. You had the White House controlled by another party. Historically, in almost every occasion, that has not occurred. You have not had a Supreme Court justice confirmed when there has been divided government. We don't have divided government this time. In fact, I have a clip from 2016 of Joe Biden speaking to this issue of whether or not a nominee should get a vote. Listen to this.
Every nominee, including Justice Kennedy in an election year,
got an up and down vote. Not much of the time, not most of the time, every single solitary time. So now I hear all this talk about the Biden rule. It's frankly ridiculous. There is no Biden rule. It doesn't exist. There's only one rule I ever followed on the Judiciary Committee. That was the Constitution's clear rule of advice and consent. And advice and consent includes consulting and voting.
Now, Joe Biden's been around a long time in the Senate, and he, you know, maybe when he first started, they didn't have audio recording. I'm just kidding. But these guys say stuff only to have it turned around and used against them. I mean, this is 2016 when there was a vacancy on the court. Of course, his history is wrong, as we were talking about with Dan McLaughlin, about the issue is the divided government. The president does what the president does. He has the constitutional authority to nominate and confirm. The Senate does what the Senate does. The Senate has the responsibility to advise and consent and to, as Joe Biden just said, to vote. And those Democratic senators that don't want a nominee to go through can vote against them. That's their constitutional prerogative. But it is also the president's to nominate. Joining me now to talk more about this, and as I mentioned, her new book, The Mind of a Conservative Woman, Seeking the Best for Family and Country, is Tennessee Senator Marsha Blackburn, who is also a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Well, thank you so much. I am delighted to join you. Thank you.
Well, I want to talk about your book. Of course, our folks want to hear about the Senate, but I want to ask you about the book in terms of the motivation there for getting this out there. I mean, you're a pro-life woman in the United States Senate. You are a champion for every conservative cause, and you're taking this message to women across the country that, you know, hey, this is for faith, family, and freedom.
Well, you're exactly right on that. And one of the things, Tony, that I would hear from women all across the country was, you know what, there's a double standard when it comes to how conservative women are treated, different from how liberal women are treated. They elevate, the media elevates and glorifies liberal women, but conservative women, if you're pro-life, pro-religion, pro-family, pro-business, they don't want to hear from you. And they say your voice doesn't need to be heard, and we're tired of that. How do we defend ourselves? And then I would talk to women's groups, women's business groups, and they would say, you know what? I've got to tell you something. I'm not political. I'm not Democrat or Republican. I vote on the issues, the person. And then I would say, tell me about your filter. What are the things that are important to you? And I would hear things like, well, I want someone who abides by the Constitution, believes in the rule of law, wants fairness, equality, justice, and equal opportunity for all. So what they were giving me was a conservative construct. And I thought, you know, most women are center, center right. It's just they don't know it. So this book is perfectly timed because it addresses that prejudice and that bias against conservatives in the public square today. And now is the time that conservative women need to stand up and fight for these values of faith, family, freedom, hope, opportunity, so that we preserve this Judeo-Christian ethic that has made this nation great.
Well, you know this, but let me say it once again, Senator Blackburn. I thank God for you and for women like you that are willing to go out there and stand against the cultural forces that want women to conform to a liberal ideology. Even if they know intuitively it's not right, they still are fearful to stand up. And I want to ask you the question is, why? Why is it that they elevate liberal women who hold to this liberal ideology, but they try to ignore conservative women and silence them?
One of the things, one of the big differences between conservatives and liberals is simply this. The liberals want the government to have the power, and they will fight, they will go to the mat for government to have the power. You give your rights to the government, and the government will give back to you what they think you need. Conservatives believe that you, the individual, have the right to dream those big dreams and make them come true, that government will be restrained by the rule of law. And that is one of these basic differences that is just so vitally important. And this is one of the reasons, I think, that the liberals try to squelch that conservative voice. Because if somebody thinks about it and says, you know what, I don't want to give up my rights. I don't want to give that power to the government. I want to make these decisions about my health care, my family, my children's education, worship where I want to worship, how I want to worship, then I think that's the problem that liberals have.
Yeah, and this, when someone like you steps out, writes a book like this, The Mind of a Conservative Woman, Seeking the Best for Family and Country, I don't want to use the word empowers. I think it affirms what moms and daughters and professional women, what they think intuitively but are afraid to say. This affirms what they're sensing, and I think it will challenge more women to stand up and speak out. I think President Trump has actually done that to a large degree.
Absolutely. And why did we elect President Trump? Because we were tired of what the elites in Washington, D.C. were doing to our freedoms. People were tired of that. And they wanted the ability to get government back where it should be. Make America great again. They were, as one of the Tennesseans that I've talked to many times would tell me, is we were during that election in 2016. He just would say repeatedly, Marsha, I'm tired of being broke, and a lot of people are tired of being broke. And I think many people were there. And the economy that President Trump has managed by working with the Republican majority in the House and the Senate, the economy that we have had, the growth that we have seen, the nature of excitement and the positive mindset that people have had. Tony, it has just been wonderful. And I will say this, this president has done so much for religious liberty and for the pro-life community and for millions of babies that had lost their lives to abortion. I am so grateful that we have had 4 years of President Donald Trump and look forward to having 4 more years.
Well, Marsha Blackburn, that brings us right to the point of the news of the day, and that is a vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court. You sit on the Judiciary Committee. The president has said he will appoint a woman. He will nominate a woman, probably making that announcement later this week. You have gone on record, along with about 20 of your colleagues, saying, yes, the president should nominate and the Senate should give a vote to the president's nominee on the Senate floor.
Yes, absolutely. That is our duty. We were elected to do our jobs. We were elected to move forward and have these hearings and then to vote someone out of committee and to handle that confirmation on the floor. And yes, we are going to do our due diligence. We are going to be thoughtful about this. We are going to approach it as we should in order to be certain that we do the people's business, which is to confirm a justice. And all these individuals that are saying, oh, well, this is not constitutional, you need to wait. There is precedent. There is precedent for the president to make this nomination and for us to move forward on that action. Now, it has happened 29 times in our past. 19 of those 29 times that a president appointed during an election year, 19 of those is when the party controlled both branches. And we know that because of this precedent, you would have to go back 130 years to 1888 to find a time when a vacancy was left open. And I will tell you this. There are, when you look at those 29 times, it breaks out like this, Tony. 19 of those times, as I said, the parties in the White House and the Senate were the same. 17 of those nominees were confirmed. There were 10 vacancies that were created before the election that there were opposing parties, and 9 of those were filled. So this is something that, yes, the president is doing his constitutional duty to nominate, and we will do our constitutional duty, and we will hold the hearings and have the confirmation vote this year.
Senator Blackburn, you mentioned the issues of life and religious liberty. Those are two issues that the courts increasingly have interjected themselves in. How prominent will those issues factor in when you consider the judicial philosophy of a justice?
The number one thing for me is this a constitutional judge? Do they believe in the rule of law? Do they abide by the Constitution? And those are going to be right at the top of my list. Of course, the life issue, the religious liberty issue, having someone who is a respecter of life and the right to life, having someone who believes in the right to worship and those First Amendment freedoms, those are going to be an imperative. But, you know, Tony, and you've heard me say many times, I've got five things that are kind of my five-word mission statement, and it is that I fight every day for preserving faith, family, freedom, hope, and opportunity. And as I look at the jurist that will be nominated when we find out whomever that is going to be, then that jurist, I'm going to see what would their actions be to preserve faith, family, freedom, hope, and opportunity.
Good framework to work from. Marcia Blackburn, we are up against the end of the program, but very quickly, where can folks get a copy of The Mind of a Conservative Woman? Where can they get it?
Oh, yes. Thank you. Every major book retailer has it, both in-store and online. So find whomever you purchase your books from and read it and pass it on to a neighbor who maybe says, well, I'm not a Democrat or a Republican. I'm an independent. We cover a lot of good history. Newt Gingrich wrote the foreword for this book. So I go back into a history of conservatism and some of our conservative writers, going back to Burke and Russell Kirk, and just a lot of good information in there. And thank you so much.
All right, Marcia Blackburn, as always, great to talk with you, and we pray for great success with the book. Folks, don't go, I guess I should say, you'll go away for today, but come back tomorrow. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul, found in Ephesians 6, where he says, you've done everything you can do when you've prayed, prepared, and taken your stand. By all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.